Thank you. Thank you very much, especially coming on Saturday night, giving up watching 60 Minutes. I appreciate it. This is not the best night for a gathering, as you know, especially when the university is not in session. But I want to run through a sequence of, shall we say, analysis, because what this campaign has demonstrated is the authoritarian tendencies of the Democratic Party and people who call themselves civil libertarians against even having our candidacy on the ballot. And in the last 2 weeks, I have gone through interchanges with people who fought the civil rights struggle, people who want diversity, people who want more voices and choices, but not someone who challenges John Kerry. You remember the old saying, somebody, who was it that said during the revolution, you know, I may disagree with you, but I'll fight to the end to preserve your right to say it. Who was that?
Voltaire.
Who?
Voltaire.
Voltaire, okay. Let me just give you a couple examples. The Black Caucus called up a few weeks ago and said, let's get together, Congressional Black Caucus. There are 39 African-American members of the House of Representatives. And so in a torrential downpour, we got down there and got down there a little late, and there were 20 members of the Black Caucus there. Significantly, some of the best members were not there that I've worked with. You know, John Lewis from Georgia, Jesse Jackson Jr., but John Conyers was there, Barbara Lee was there. And I wish you could have seen that exchange. These were the people who either were in the early civil rights struggle, although most of them were not, they were younger. But their parents were, and their parents basically said to the white man, you're no longer going to tell us not to vote, and you're no longer going to tell us not to run. It's over. And I'm sitting there listening to one after another of the Congressional Black Caucus, not all of them, one after another, say, withdraw, don't run. At the same time that they said, we respect your right to run. We respect your right to run, Mr. Nader, but withdraw. And I'm sitting here and I'm saying, look at this scene. Here we are, all of us in this room. This is the congressional room. Prisoners of a 200-year-old system of electoral college, winner-take-all, set up for a two-party duopoly. Prisoners, hostages to it, created by highly revered founding fathers, many of whom were slave owners. And I'm watching 20 members of the Congressional Black Caucus, maybe 12 of them, in tumultuous outrage that the Nader-Kamejo ticket, and Peter Kamejo was right next to me, would dare challenge the Democrats and Republicans in this election. In fact, one of the members of the Black Caucus from Texas pointed to Peter Kamejo and said, and now, Mr. Nader, you have chosen a vice presidential running mate who speaks Spanish, and he can speak Spanish to my constituents. In other words, he can take away the vote. And she's got a safe seat to begin with. So I'm trying to digest this, because this is very serious. I'm trying to digest this, and I'm saying to him, well, look, there's one plus. Look, we agree on the issues. We agree we want to defeat George W. Bush. And you have your way to do it, and we have our way to do it. And I've been watching your party lose for the last 10 years to the worst of the Republican Party at the local, state, and national level, and now you're telling us, trust us again? You even lost an election in 2000 that you won. The Gore election. So, and the election was stolen in Florida, and they all nodded, and I said, why don't you go after the thieves instead of the Greens? So, well, I mean, it was tumultuous. Now, you know, look, I was fighting for African-American rights, Negroes in those days, when most of these people were in short pants. In the 50s, the whole surge in the Little Rock High School, and the thing that really upset me the most as a law student was the constant designation of black people as genetically inferior mentally. And one day I was at law school, I pick up U.S. News and World Report, and the cover says, prominent psychologist documents that blacks are mentally inferior. And so I spent weeks trying to get a rebuttal to this in the Harvard Law School newspaper that went out to thousands of Harvard Law School lawyers, alumni. And I finally got Ashley Montague, the anthropologist from Rutgers at the time, to write a rebuttal. And so I didn't want to go through this. One thing I hate to do when I have meetings like that is start touting all the things we've done. But apparently, that didn't matter to them, even if they knew about it. It didn't matter that we have maps on every city in the country showing redlining against low-income people by banks. It didn't matter that we've been trying to do something on lead-based poisoning of minority children, age 2, 3, peeling off tenant walls. It didn't matter that we campaigned in 2000 in poor areas that wouldn't even be on the screen by Gore and Bush. It didn't matter that time and time again we would beg the Congress to do something about the economic exploitation of people in the ghettos, landlord abuses, code violations, inadequate municipal services, predatory lending, payday loan rackets, 400% interest. Things like redlining was a general category, but there were other things that were just make life miserable with the few consumer dollars they have to spend. Do you know a lot of the dirty meat is put into the shipped into the local income, lower income areas in our country? The shoddy merchandise. Do you know that in Washington there's Ward 8? I was the only person ever to campaign in Anacostia in Washington, D.C. because the Democrats own it and the Republicans just use it for a fundraising base in the hotels. And I went into the poor areas, and in Ward 8, 65,000 people in Washington live in Ward 8. They don't have a single supermarket. They got to go to Maryland or another part of the district. All they have are these schlocky, you know, quasi-boutique type things that are selling you candy and all kinds of junk food. They don't even have a supermarket. We've had a black mayor in Washington, D.C. for 30, 35 years. We've had black city councilmen for 30, 35 years. And the Congressional Black Caucus is lecturing me about this. Like, don't mess up our little party, because don't worry. Bush is terrible. Don't you know how bad, terrible Bush is? I told him I know how bad Bush is. And I'm not going to rely on a Democratic Party to try to lose again unless Bush self-destructs, which he's starting to do. But if Bush self-destructs, as he's starting to do, how can anyone support Kerry without demanding a mandate, without demanding basic commitments on one issue after another? When I met with John Kerry about a month ago, I've known him since he got back from Vietnam, I said, you know, this made him real nervous. I said, you know, Bush is sort of self-destructing. You know, this may be an easy one. Oh, he got very nervous. He said, no, it's going to be a tough fight. And I said to him, but you're not getting a mandate. All these groups supporting, like Sierra Club and labor unions and civil rights, they're not demanding anything of you because they're so freaked out over Bush. You go in the White House, you don't have any mandate.
He
said, don't worry, just wait until I get in the White House. Yeah. But 24 hours a day, you know who's pulling the Democrats? The corporate interests. They're pulling them in every conceivable manner. And if people who support John Kerry are not pulling any other way, what's going to happen? Again, the least worst approach to presidential elections means that every 4 years, both parties get worse because there's no pull in the progressive direction. Because people say, anybody but Bush. Anybody but Bush. Anybody but Bush ensures that the Democrats are going to be worse because they're being pulled in one direction. That's where the money is, the corporate money. That's where the associations and the country club, that's where the nominees are. That's who goes into the government. That's who gets appointed to the judiciary, corporate lawyers who've given all kinds of money to the Democratic Party. So then one of the members of the Black Caucus said, I don't care about anything else. Bush has got to go just because of the Supreme Court. Do you realize what can happen to our people in just one or two more nominations? I said, funny you brought that up. I said, who do you despise on the Supreme Court? Scalia, Thomas. Well, let's look at that. I was up there lobbying against both of them. Scalia was confirmed 98-0, including Gore. I couldn't get one senator to oppose him. Just for the record. And how about Thomas, an unworthy successor to Thurgood Marshall? The Democrats were in control of the Senate. They could have blocked it. 11 Democrats moved across the aisle, joined the Republicans, and confirmed Thomas 52-48. While George Mitchell, the Senate Majority Leader, was sitting in his office twiddling his thumbs and not using his muscle. Don't tell me about the Supreme Court. And then here's the one that really rubs all the Democrats on Capitol Hill wrong. You say, you know, we can forgive you for not proposing anything that the American people need, seriously. But why can't you stop things that are bad for the American people? Why can't you stop the tax cut for the wealthy in 2001 and 2003 that you fulminated against rhetorically? When you had the votes to stop it in the Senate, you could have filibustered it. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. They don't like people who can distinguish between the words and the deeds of politicians. The Democrats are much better rhetorically on a lot of these. They're much better environmentally, rhetorically. Let's look at Clinton Gore's record. They gave 8 years holiday to the auto companies without any proposal to increase fuel efficiency. Didn't do anything about SUVs. Didn't do anything about auto safety. They gave a holiday to the biotech industry. Wouldn't even require labeling of GMO foods in the supermarket, supported by 90% of the American people. They were so scared of Monsanto. They left the petrochemical industry alone, the pesticide industry alone. They put through WTO, which is the most anti-environmental trade agreement in American history. We have three slogans operating in our campaign. We permit ourselves three slogans. One is freedom from fear. Freedom from fear. The second is shift the power from corporations to people as workers and consumers and communities. And the third is a solution revolution. We have so many solutions that are on the shelf or in little pilot projects here and there all over the country, and they're not being diffused because they upset the big guys. We don't know how to have massive energy efficiency, which will reduce the sales of ExxonMobil. We don't know how to do affordable housing. We don't know how to do public transit. We don't know how to run an educational system as if the students mattered first, instead of a system basically at its best that has them looking at screens at age 7 and 8 and 9, that has them memorizing, regurgitating, and vegetating, heaven forbid, critical thinking. Don't we have the teachers who know how to teach them if they're free to do so? Instead of this insipid, leave no child behind, high stake frequency, multiple choice, standardized testing fraud that Bush and the Democrats passed. Some of you may remember Gandhi's little couplets, you know, like science without compassion and politics without integrity. He called them the deadly social sins. And I have two more. And one is called belief without thought. And the second is called respect without self-respect. We have to have civic self-respect. We have to have a higher estimate of our own significance than being led through the nose to go for the least worst of two parties who are only proxies for the corporate government in Washington, D.C., corporate occupied territory. There's no end logic to the least worst. We played the least worst game. 14 of us, full-time in 1984, went all over the country trying to show people the difference between Mondale and Reagan. And nobody listened. It wasn't that easy, by the way, on some issues. 1988, Dukakis, Bush. It doesn't matter. The only way the civic community can shape up the political arena is to get in it. Is to change it, because you can have the best political movement. If it doesn't parallel a strong civic movement, it's going to be corrupted. You can have a strong civic movement, they don't pass the laws. If you have a corrupt political system, it's not going to make it. We got to go forward together. Now, Lula was elected president of Brazil. The real thing. Came out of the labor movement, came out of poverty, and now they say he's in trouble because he's besieged by the IMF and the World Bank and the monopoly capitalists and the oligarchs and the plutocrats and the big landowners. And what he needs is a parallel mass mobilization. As Saul Alinsky, the great organizer in Chicago, once said, the only way to deal with organized money is with organized people. And so they're talking, is he going to fail? Is he moving to the right? Well, if you looked at what he's up against, he's up against a situation where if he doesn't have mass mobilization behind him and he tries to do what he wants to do, there'll be another military junta, as there was in 1964, where we subsequently learned through a Freedom of Information Act there was a nice U.S. battleship a few miles off Rio de Janeiro, just in case. This was an overthrow of a democratically elected government by the junta. So let me go through the sequence here of this campaign. That's quite important. And I'm sure you've met your share of what we call viral liberals. The viral liberal is a well-intentioned person who would like a better country, but is so seized with fear that they'll go to the end of time with the least worst choice, and that means the Democrats. And once you have an anybody but Bush mindset, it doesn't matter who you are. You could be a Nobel laureate. You could be a brilliant political scientist. You could be a brilliant historian. You will stop thinking. I've had letters from all of them. Totally stop thinking. We have to get rid of Bush. Nothing else matters. Do not consider any agenda, strategies, tactics, alternative ways to defeat him. Put all your eggs in the Democratic Party empty basket. All thinking stops. That's why we call it a virus. Because a virus catches from one person to another. It's the same virus. It's a mind closer. And so what it tells us basically is that there are very few people who have a well-grounded public philosophy that will absorb a variety of realities, a variety of variables and historical experience. And I just gave you one example, which is what happens in a corporatized government in Washington when you don't demand anything of your candidate, John Kerry, in return. What happens is that he and his party will be further corporatized. The progressives in the Democratic Party will be further marginalized. That's what will happen. That's a variable. You can't get a discussion. So let's go into the analysis here. Rome was not built in a day. We have to form and build a political movement. We have a good opportunity now, because the liberal Democrats have abandoned us. They'll go back into the fold. But we have millions and millions of voters to scramble for. 100 million non-voters that somehow the Democrats and Republicans have so written off that they go crazy if there's a minor Republican challenge to the incumbent or if there's a Green Party challenge. You know, the Democrats say, we don't want you to spoil it this time. I say, well, what do you mean by that? We got 3 million votes or so last time. Well, that spoiled it for us. Well, how come only 1 million of those votes were Democrats? Are you worried about that? Very worried about that. But don't you know that 8 million Democrats in 2000 left you and voted for George W. Bush, the bumbling governor from Texas who can't put three sentences together? Oh, they're not worried about 8 million voters. Huh? And how about the 100 million non-voters? Why don't you scramble for some of them instead of writing them off as know-nothings? Maybe they know too much. Now, when a party focuses on one vote to get back and not eight of their own votes to get back, that's a sign of their decadence. They're heavy into scapegoating. They're not looking at their own decay. They're not looking at why they cannot landslide a corrupt, completely corporatized Republican Party that is against workers demonstrably, against consumers demonstrably, against the environment demonstrably, against the small taxpayer demonstrably, for the wealthy, and has the latest poll showing 67% of the American people think that George W. Bush cares more about the interests of corporations than the interests of the American people. How come the Democratic Party's not landsliding? Because they've got the same problem. They're dialing for the same dollars. They're indentured to the same interest. I asked that very question in a telephone conversation with John Kerry in late December. And I said, how come the Democratic Party is not landsliding the Republicans? Because you think the Republicans are bad, and I think they're worse. And you know what he said? This is a perfect litmus paper test of the decadence of this party. He said, it's because the Republicans have so much money to cloud the issues. That's what it is. It's always money. Why didn't you win the Congress in 2002 when you had the biggest corporate crime wave in American history emblazoned on the nightly news, Enron, WorldCom, Tyco, and all the newspapers? You didn't even have to beg the reporters to cover it. It was the Achilles heel of the Republican Party, Kenny Lay and George W. Bush and Enron and all the funding from these corporate crooks. Why didn't you make that an issue? Instead, you anointed George W. Bush in October with your unconstitutional war resolution as a wartime president, and he went around the country beating up on your candidates, and you didn't challenge him because he was a wartime president. And you're blaming the Greens for that one? They lost the House by a swing vote of 100,000 and the Senate by 41,000. So it's very close. You think they would be exuding confidence now? You ask a reporter in Washington whether the Democrats are exuding confidence about taking the Congress back. And when I said to the Congressional Black Caucus, well, how about giving us one? I mean, if we spill over some votes, you know, it may make the difference. I mean, you lost one House by 100,000, the other 41. You lose some Senate seats by 1-2%, you get a little spillover vote from a Nader Kameo ticket. I mean, that's a win-win proposition. Oh, no. They didn't want to hear it. They didn't want, nor were the others Democrats that I spoke to. I do a lot of dialing for the Democrats. They say, what's wrong? They don't want to hear it. And they don't want to hear it because underneath it all is the following. Money is the mother's milk of their politics. That's the most important thing to them because that's what they think gets them reelected, which is a contemptuous view of politics, isn't it? That it isn't message, it isn't organization in the precincts, it isn't standing up for the dispossessed and the denied and the frauded and the tens of millions of people who get pushed around every day and the single mom who has to have two jobs and raise a family on a $7 an hour Walmart wages. I mean, if you cannot stand up for the workers whose lives are being lost because of occupational diseases, if you can't stand up for 80,000 Americans who are getting killed every year, according to the Harvard School of Public Health, due to medical malpractice in hospitals alone, if you cannot stand up for 47 million people who work full-time and don't make anywhere near a living wage, $6, $7, $8, $9 an hour, if you cannot stand up for 45 million Americans who don't have health insurance, if you can't stand up for those families whose sons and daughters are being used as fodder for George W. Bush's unconstitutional war, who are you going to stand up for? You know, here's George W. Bush. He plunges our nation into an unconstitutional war. It's amazing. Article 1, Section 8 is viewed as a technicality in Washington. That was the highest form of wisdom, according to James Madison, in their deliberations establishing the Constitution. They did not want one person in the White House to declare war for the United States of America. It was going to be done by Congress, a deliberative group, and they certainly had enough time, didn't they, to deliberate on the Iraq thing. This was not an incoming missile from the Soviet Union. It was exactly the kind of situation that the Founding Fathers had anticipated. He plunges our nation into a war based on a platform of fabrications, deceptions, and lies. And the Democrats didn't stop him. John Kerry voted for the war resolution. But he thought George W. Bush would go to the United Nations. But he thought it would be more multilateral. But he thought this, but he thought that was an unconstitutional resolution to begin with. But you know, nobody can challenge it in court. Did you know that? Any American in this country that took the Congress to court for not violating the constitutional authority invested in it under Article 1, Section 8 would be thrown out of court for lack of standing to sue. The only person who could sue to invoke that violation would be the Attorney General of the United States. The Founding Fathers had a lot of foresight, but they didn't ever dream that any branch of government would willingly give up its constitutional authority. And so what George W. Bush has done is concentrate enormous power, because he's a wartime president, right? Enormous power in the White House at the expense of the judiciary, which is being diminished, and the legislative branch, which is being diminished willingly. Hey, they don't want a responsibility. Take it, George. We don't want this on our back. We got fundraising parties to go to. And look at the situation we're now in. This is going to cost at least $200 billion. We have at least 20,000 serious casualties and fatalities. You don't want to count the Israeli, Iraqi casualties. You don't want to come close to that. I was going to say the Israeli because we don't count the Palestinian casualties. They get a little squib when 20 of them are destroyed. But the Iraqi casualties are enormous, not only in trauma. They've been exposed to depleted uranium. They've died because there aren't enough medicines. They have had contaminated water. They have been undernourished. They have been subject to all kinds of vendettas because the U.S. is not able to maintain street security, which under international law they are obligated to do. When you take over a country, topple a government, you're responsible for that. And so what I'm writing Bush a letter on Tuesday demanding a full accounting of all the U.S. casualties and diseases, because because You know, the Pentagon only tells you the fatalities and injuries in combat. They don't tell you the outside of combat, deaths, injuries, severe mental breakdowns, and diseases, like the sandfly disease, which is very, very serious in many cases. None of those are cataloged because they're not considered. Imagine the Bush administration won't even give us the numbers. They don't have the decency even to give us the numbers. Now, because Bush developed a political formula, which is concentrate the attention of the public on Iraq and terrorism, he's developed a magnet for terrorism now in Iraq. And the way you fight terrorism is not to do it in a way that produces more. And he's producing more. And it's a recruitment. Iraq now is a recruitment agency for stateless terrorists. I always use the word stateless terrorists because the most devastating terrorists of all in the last 100 years have been state terrorist instrumentalities. And as a result, look at the political advantages to Bush that the Democrats have let him get away with because of the Iraq thing and the focus on the terrorism bit. One, he silences public dissent quite a bit. Two, he chills out the Democrats. Three, he distracts attention from the necessities here at home, which he's not very good at responding to. Because it's all Iraq. Look at the media. Iraq, right? Not Peoria, Salinas, Buffalo, you know, what's going on in the country. Four, all kinds of great contracts for his corporate buddies, who then for every $100 in contracts, they break a penny in half and send it to the Republican National Committee and Bush's treasury. This is a great deal. This is the best. Bush's government is the best money can buy. Very good bargain. And finally, he concentrates power in his hands. It's only now the press is getting skeptical. They rolled over for him. They were cheerleaders. They were lied to. And then they said, well, you know, enough is enough. They have some integrity left, and they've been going after him. I thought one of the best buttons that I've seen around the country said, he lied, they died. He lied, they died. Some of you might want to pick up a book by retired Marine general. He wrote it in 1939. Any of you ever read this book by Smedley Butler?
Yeah.
Have you read the book, actually? Because it's just been reissued in paperback by the Butler family, some publisher in Los Angeles. And the title of the book is, I Was a Racketeer for Capitalism. And he started going in, you know, I made Nicaragua safe for National Bank. I made this country safe for the U.S. sugar interest. I opened up China for the oil companies and so forth. And it was the most magnificent confession of what he did for 40 years. He's the most, at the time, most decorated Marine in the Marine Corps. But one thing he said I'll never forget. He said, and he even praised the troops and trick the troops and make them think that soldiers are representing the United States of America when they're just representing these overseas U.S. corporations that are exploiting the people. And that's when you know the politician is getting worried. The more George W. Bush wraps the troops around him at these photo opportunities, the more he praises them, the more he's hanging on politically with that symbol. And he's doing it more and more frantically. Here he is, a draft dodger. Here's a guy who got into the Texas Air National Guard through political connections. And he loved the Vietnam War, he said, but he just wanted someone else to do the fighting for him. And what's so disreputable about Bush is that when we were opposing the war, one thing we did almost like a last-ditch effort in January and February, before the war in March, was we got a lot of the major anti-war groups that represented veterans. These are individual groups. They represented business, represented retired intelligence, they represented women, they for peace, they represented students, they represented, labor, church groups, you know, National Council of Churches. Anyway, there are 13. And we urged them to write the final letter to Bush as the drums of war were being beat. Hysteria. It was like what we read about the Spanish-American War and, you know, Teddy Roosevelt and the yellow journalists and Hearst. I mean, we showed ourselves how fragile our democracy really is. And They all wrote him a letter respectfully asking to meet with him, because he had never once met with a group critical of his impending war. Just think of the closed mind. This is what led me to call him a messianic militarist, which is what he is. And he talks about being the will of providence, and God put him on earth to liberate. And you got these Islamic peoples in these countries wondering, hey, this could be a religious war. I mean, they've tasted it once, called the Four Crusades, right? And here's this man talking religious talk when he's a secular president. He did not bother to respond to one of those letters. Not even a courtesy response to the veterans from the Gulf War who wrote the letter. And a lot of these groups had been over to Iraq, and they knew that it was going to be trouble after the invasion. And they had something to tell him. That's what we're dealing with. Now, who allowed this man to get elected? Who allowed this man to get elected governor of Texas? Who allowed this man to get elected president? Or even after he didn't get elected, to get selected? Who is allowing this? Always appraise the parties in two ways. How much are they advancing and how much are they stopping? And the Democrats have a very, very serious responsibility here. We have to have this as a confrontation with corporate power. Our country is being racked by the collision of commercial interests against civic interests. Commercial interests are dominating more and more. You can see it decade by decade. They're now raising our children. They are breaching parental authority over children by direct marketing to children insidiously with the latest applied psychology. And they're selling them violence as a solution to life's problems, and low-grade sensuality, and junk food, and addiction as a way of life. Just keep staring and eating those junk foods. Stare at screens. And they're undermining parental authority. This would not have been tolerated 40, 50 years ago. That's the insidious collision of commercial values against civic values. And you see it everywhere. They're corporatizing our universities. They're selling our elections. They're commercializing our government. They are commercializing our tax dollars, called corporate welfare, subsidies, handouts, giveaways, etc. They are even commercializing our minds. We're beginning to lose the essential determination to draw a bright line for our democracy, where there are certain areas of our society that are sanctuaries from commercialism, that they have to be protected. Our elections should not be for sale. Our politicians should not be for sale. Our universities should not be for sale. Our childhood should not be for sale. Our environment should not be for sale. And we're losing that distinction because they're getting into our minds at a very early age. And because we have not allowed ourselves space for contrasting political parties and political candidates, because our expectation levels have been driven down and we're settling for less and less and less. Isn't it time we ask, why not the best, the way Jimmy Carter did? And he's right. All right. Lots of short sentences to make important points for lack of time. Our campaign is going to be a flat-out nation campaign. We are not going to leave the people who want a new politics in states that happen to be close between the Republicans and Democrats behind. We will never betray those people. Any third party or independent candidate who says that he or she is going to pursue a safe state strategy is going to eliminate the only leverage they're going to have on one or both of the two parties, because they don't care about Texas or New York. The two parties have essentially abandoned 35 states to each other. Abandoned them. And as a result, they're turning our country, together with redistricting, into a one-party state. For 95% of the voters in this country, they don't even have two candidates, Republican, Democrat. They have one. This is the Stalinist movement in America, American style. One, that's all they had. In 95% of the districts in the House are deemed non-competitive, controlled by one party or another, by the parties themselves. That's their phrase, non-competitive. This is what they left us with. Redistricting, the Democrats abandoning states like Texas and Georgia to the Republicans, the Republicans abandoning states like Massachusetts and now California. We're left with one person on the ballot. Either there's no one on the other side even on the ballot, it's just a nominal, you know, some accountant wants to get a little publicity, go back to his accounting practice at some congressional level. Number two is we take no commercial money. We take no PAC money. We only take contributions from individuals who believe that we must have more voices and choices in this country, and we must build, however small, however big, in any given election cycle, a new political movement. Our country is in deep trouble. Giant corporations now have never been more dominant over our political economy and media and educational system. Giant corporations are keeping America down in one area after another. They are distinctly unpatriotic. They have no allegiance to this country or communities in our country other than to control them or abandon them to China or elsewhere as they see fit. They are very unpatriotic. We must begin to evaluate corporations on the standard of patriotism. They have no allegiance to our country or any country in the world. They are basically in a state where they prefer to be stateless. Astride the globe, cutting deals with dictators who repress their workers and calling it free trade. There can be no free trade with dictators. Dictators determine wages. Dictators determine externality costs like pollution controls. There is no free market in China. You cannot have free trade with a country that is a dictator. There are no trade unions in China. There are no market-determined prices. These prices are determined by the central regime. And here we have a conservative Republican president facilitating, sending his Department of Commerce emissaries to conferences, encouraging U.S. industry to pull up stakes and move to China, the same industries that fund his campaign. Encouraging U.S. industries to move to a despotic communist regime in China. How do you like that for an irony? You think the Democrats could make hay with that? Of course not. They're doing the same thing. This is the problem. They're holding America down in one area after another. For example, who is saying no to universal health care? It's the HMOs, the hospital chains, the health insurance companies, and the drug companies. They're saying no, and they're making it stick over 50 years after Truman first proposed it to a Congress that didn't accept it. We're the only country in the Western world without it, by the way. Who is saying no to reasonable drug prices? The big drug companies. And they're swarming over Congress. They have 650 full-time paid lobbyists to lobby 535 members of Congress. Not to mention the money they're spending and pouring into their coffers on Capitol Hill, which we now call Wuthering Heights. Who is saying no to efficient energy and solar energy? We know it's ExxonMobil, it's Peabody Coal, it's the nuclear industry. Who is saying no to a fair system of taxation that starts with taxing wealth, not work first, that starts with taxing the things we like the least? Like, why don't we tax pollution? Why don't we tax gambling more? Why don't we tax the addictive industries like alcohol and cigarettes more? Why don't we tax stock pick speculation, which would bring us huge revenues? Why? Because the corporations are saying no. Who's saying no to living wage? Your guess is better than mine. It's McDonald's. It's Walmart. It's Kmart. It's all these chains that think that Americans can support families, not only one person, on $7 or $8 an hour before the cost of getting to work, another used car, another insurance policy, another repair bill. Who is saying no to demilitarization of foreign policy and the cutting of that bloated, wasteful, redundant, corrupt Pentagon budget with their military contractors who are shaping our defense policy? It's Lockheed Martin, it's Boeing, it's Raytheon, it's General Dynamics. We now have enough weapons to blow up the world 300 times and make the rubble bounce. Why do we need more nuclear submarines? Why do we need more bombers? Why do we need more atrocious anti-personnel weapons with flechette, razor flechette, that are killing children and adults long after the hostilities have disappeared in one country after another? And by the way, these flechettes now are painted black with a paint that acts as an anticoagulant. How would you like to go to work and manufacture those in our country? We don't have a major enemy left in the world. There's no more Soviet Union. Communist China wants our industries. They're not going to send missiles over here. Why do we have a gigantic military budget that depletes and bleeds the necessary taxpayer revenues for our schools, clinics, drinking water systems, public libraries, and so many other things that are crumbling before our eyes, called the public works or infrastructure in our country? Indeed, the Pentagon budget was just voted in the Senate, $440 billion, and that's not all of it. There's more in the Department of Energy and the nuclear weapons and on and on. You know what the vote was? Unanimous. Unanimous. Where are the dissenters in the Senate? Where are the Wayne Morrises, the Ernest Groenings, the Gaylord Nelsons? Where are they? Where is courage? Where is it?
You.
What you mean? Who is saying? Thank you. Who is saying no to abolishing poverty in this country? There are conservative economists 40 and 50 years ago who showed us plans to abolish poverty. Richard Nixon proposed to Congress a minimum incomes plan that set the stage for the abolition of poverty, and Congress rebuffed him. We had poverty in 1900. We have poverty today. Some of it is a new kind of poverty. Some of it is a very old kind of poverty. Terrible housing, hunger for children. And guess what? Our economy has increased in production per capita 25-fold adjusted for inflation since 1900. Why is there any poverty? Why aren't the workers benefiting from the productivity that they are a part of? When Walmart increases its productivity, when Home Depot increases its productivity, and you go in and you can't find anybody to answer your questions, and they turn you into a worker as a consumer. Why aren't the workers benefiting? Why aren't the workers in those automated plants benefiting? Why is it that a majority of the workers today are making less in wages than they made in 1973, adjusted for inflation? This has never happened before in American history. They used to say a growing economy lifts all boats. Now we say a growing economy lifts all yachts. Finally, let me say this. The corporations are planning our future. That's what they call strategic planning. They are planning our political future in all the ways we know. They're planning the future of our elections in all the ways we know. They're planning our tax future. Escape. They want to go to Bermuda. They want to escape taxes and get all the benefits here without paying their fair share. 60% of corporations in the U.S. paid no taxes last year, federal income taxes. 70% U.S. foreign corporations operating, the foreign corporations operating in this country pay no federal income tax. Actually, it's the year 2002 is the latest figure. These corporations are engaged in strategic planning on how to turn 8-year-olds into consumers of the most disreputable products, worthless products, junk food that predisposes them to obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, in a very seductive manner. McDonald's, it's a child's world. You know what was behind that phrase? Incredible polling and research. That was a signal to kids to disregard their parents and nag them. Not to listen to them, to nag them. It's a child's world. The corporations are planning our educational future. Look at the drive to commercialize or privatize public education. Look at the drive to take over universities and depress civic courses, humanities and social sciences, in favor of a trade school mentality. These corporations are planning our foreign policy. They're even planning our genetic future. They now have thousands of patents on genetically engineered organisms, flora, fauna, and human. Now, isn't it time for us to start planning our own futures? Must we not give ourselves a chance to clarify the issues in this campaign, to think for ourselves, to go against the wind of the mind-closing anybody but Bush? If only so your liberal friends don't come back to you in a year if Kerry is elected and say, you know, you were right. He's just such a disappointment. We have a failed drug war that turns hundreds of thousands of addicted citizens into prison instead of into rehabilitation. Do we imprison nicotine addicts or alcoholics? Why are we imprisoning drug addicts, which only makes the problem worse and costs us far more than rehabilitation? We have a problem of over-medication of our children. It's going to be terrible. Antibiotic resistance. We have labor unions that cannot be formed because of our anti-labor laws. And do you ever hear a Democrat utter the words, repeal the Taft-Hartley law? Do you ever hear those Democrats? What do you do with the party? What do you do? What do you do with a party that turns us back on the two major constituencies that make all their elections possible? Working, labor, and minorities. And that's what they're doing. Because they know that these people are signaling, you can take us for granted. And when you signal to a politician that he or she can take you for granted, you know what happens? You get taken. And when you go for the least worst, that's exactly what you get. The least. There's a lot more to talk about, no more time. I just want to leave you with this. Do not hesitate to initiate conversations. Word of mouth is the most powerful tool you have. You've got friends, relatives, you've got coworkers, you've got neighbors. Don't abide by this unspoken convention, oh, they got their politics and we got ours. How many times have you heard that? Oh, I don't want to talk politics, these people. How many times have you had young people say, I'm not into politics? If you're not into politics, politics will turn on you. That's the lesson of history. And so I hope that you support us. I hope that you'll go and get more signatures, that you will organize get-out-the-vote units. We call them 12ers. One active person gets 12 relatives, friends, neighbors, and talks politics in the fall and then says, let's all go together to the polls and let's all come back and have a nice supper or lunch. We've got to have that because you're not going to see big fancy ads, 30-second ads on TV. You'll see a lot of good material on our website, votenator.org. It's going to break the mold. It's going to show that presidential politics has been very routine, very much in a rut, very ritualistic, very uninnovative. I think the last innovation in presidential campaigning, apart from use of the internet, was television makeup. Kennedy used it, Nixon didn't in the 1960 debates, as some of you know. You've heard the phrase, people have the power? Patti Smith? Right? Okay. By the way, if all the Hollywood people supported us, only one is with us today. Patti Smith. Michael Moore, someone went to Kucinich. She's a very good person. I understand that. Michael Moore said in the USA Today on Friday, he's going to try to take my 4-6% voters and give them to Kerry. Yeah. Did you hear Michael Moore in 2000 at our rallies, what he said about the Democrats? This is what happens when you're desperate, fearful, anybody that Bush, mind closing. That's what happens. The people have the power only if they recognize it, Only if they collaborate in the neighborhood, only if they organize it, only if they focus it. Is there a better use of your time? Your children are at stake. Your grandchildren are at stake. Your country and your world is at stake. And we have enormous leverage in our country because of the country we live in compared to other people like us in other countries. And we've got to rise to the occasion. We've got to have a high significance of our impact in this election, and we've got to spread the word. Thank you very much.